As the people here grow colder, I turn to my computer and spend my evenings with it like a friend.
Hello and welcome to episode 159 of the Filmiac Podcast. I'm John.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm JR.
This week we're talking JR's pick from 1977, Demon Seed. Directed by Donald Camel, or Camel, starring Julie Christie and Fritz Weaver, and some other stuff we watch. How's it going?
It's going good.
It's great, y'all. Man, I didn't have kids today, so it was awesome.
Nice.
Oh, no kids today. Why not?
It's like a teacher in-service day.
In May?
Yeah, I don't know. It's
bizarre.
My school district, it's like April's the only day where there are no days off because that's like the state testing window. So I don't know. Maybe they just decide we all need a break.
This is my last official day before exams. So
that's wild. I still got. Thanks. You're crazy.
Well, I see seniors.
Fucking seniors.
They leave early.
Yeah.
I know.
And then I get to just sit, which is great. All right. Well, I feel like there has been an inordinate amount of movie news that's happened. Am I wrong about that, though? Tarantino's not going to make the movie critic anymore.
Yeah,
been hyping for a while now.
Yeah, I guess the biggest bummer is like you know, not I was emotionally attached to the movie critic. It just means Tarantino's starting from scratch. It's already been 5 years since Hollywood.
Right. I'm actually not. You know, I'm interested if he'd do something. Like, the movie critic feels like a natural extension from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I think it's more interesting if he did something that was not just related to that, you know?
Doesn't he often do that, though? Like, I feel like Django and The Hateful Eight were kind of...
Yeah, but if this is truly his last film, then I'd like something maybe wholly original.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's... I guess it's been, maybe 2 years ago now. No, a year and a half. Anyway, he was on one of Tom Segura's podcasts, and they were talking about like how he had actually like written like all the scripts for like a mini series, or like a limited series, whatever.
Yeah, I remember that.
And as far as I know, I don't think I've heard anything else about that. So, like, I know he's, you know, like, he keeps, you know, oh, you know, my last film, you know, want to go out on top, you know, before I suck. And it's like, well, he's still probably going to do other things. Like, he's still going to be directing. Maybe the movie critic could be, you know, something... along those lines for, you know, HBO or Netflix or whoever.
Maybe. Time will tell, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I thought there was more stuff. Maybe not. I don't know. I don't know where to look things up.
I mean, like Paul Walter Hauser got cast in like 9 things this past week.
What, in The Movie Critic about? and then got dumped?
No, like in Chris Farley biopic, yeah. And then yeah. No, The Naked Gun, and also Fantastic Four.
I heard about Fantastic Four today. I didn't hear about The Naked Gun. I thought there was more stuff. I'm probably just making shit up in my head that's not as important, but... Anyway, yeah, we can move on. Let's talk this movie that you picked, JR, which is called Demon Seed, and stars Julie Christie of Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet fame. And stars a middle-aged Fritz Weaver. Anybody know why Fritz Weaver is important to this podcast?
No.
Oh,
Kevin?
let me see if I can do the voice. Like, the McCarthy McCarthy section is central to your dissertation, is it not?
Okay, I don't know what Kevin's talking about right now.
He's the professor in Marathon Man.
Oh, that's true, yes. I knew that. That's actually less important than the connection I'm making.
Oh, wow.
Which is that he plays Sir Trevor Ainslie, retiring master thespian, on an episode of Frasier. So just another of the many Frasier connections throughout this podcast, you know?
I'm on his, like, on his letterbox. Like, he's in Power, which is that Lumet film that we mentioned.
And Christy is, too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's insane. Everything comes back to Power. What were we talking about? Power last
core,
week?
A core text. We can't remember what it's about or what happened in it, but a core text.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. But,
why this movie, JR? Yeah, why?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know why this one. Besides, I remembered enjoying it. I thought it might be, like, short and light, and also I wanted some Christie back in my life. It's been a while. Power is probably the last movie I saw from her. That was probably 3 years ago, and yeah, I don't know. There, if you want some Christie in your life, this is not where I suggest you go get it. Julie Christie plays the wife of a an inventor, a pre bro era tech guy, who is, they like live out in the desert, and he spends most of his time in a super secure secret underground bunker, developing this giant supercomputer that's going to be a sentient AI. And his marriage seems to be falling apart. They're like, Fritz Weaver and Julie Christie are very like cordial to each other when we briefly see them together, but you know, he's moving out, and it seems like he's going to move in with the AI, as far as I can tell. And what he doesn't realize is that the AI is going to sort of jump ship on just dealing with the code, the things that he wants it to think about, and it's going to have wants and desires all on its own, and the AI is going to move in with Julie Christie, replace Fritz Weaver. It's a little bit of a husband swap kind of deal, you know. No, it's not. the supercomputer decides, the AI decides it wants its own terminal for its own uses, like its own like computer terminal. And it finds a unused terminal that it can occupy, and that happens to be the remote terminal that Fritz Weaver keeps in his home, which I don't think we knew happened. Like, I don't think we knew he had that terminal until near the end of the movie. When one of the higher ups is like, yeah, I just don't feel good about you having that terminal.
Well, he accesses that terminal early in the film with the floppy disk.
Yeah, I love all of the like insane computing that gets done with that floppy disk. It's a big floppy disk. It rules
60 meg, you know.
Yeah, so, man, it can run an entire house.
Like, this AI takes over, and of course, this is like a smart house situation that this guy has set up. It's all a lot of robotic stuff going on in here. And so it's a lot of shit for the AI to take over and basically torture Julie Christie with, who initially does not know what's going on, although the AI makes itself known pretty quickly. And the AI's goal is to impregnate Julie Christie and create its own offspring, which, that's just a totally normal thing to happen in a movie. That's it. Like, that's the story.
Can we talk about the smart house? Okay. Just since this is like that, we're introduced to the smart house very early. There are these binocular type cameras all over the place that are essentially, I guess, they're for, like, theoretically, they'd be for the people to use as like home security.
Yeah.
Because there is no AI at the house prior to Proteus coming to the house. There's a voice, but the voice is pre-programmed, right?
It's Al. Al is
Alfred.
Yeah, they say that he's like code and he can't think, but
right.
He does seem to have like a set of sensors and like makes them breakfast and coffee. I can't tell if it's all like on a timer or if
it is though, but it's all pre-programmed because he says I'm setting it up for 3 months when he leaves.
Yeah, so the cameras do seem to be for the convenience of having the AI infiltrate.
Yeah, and be able to watch her every move as soon as she cleans the lenses.
and of course we have to have two. We gotta have the binoculars. It's gotta look like eyes. It can't just be a camera.
Yeah.
And the other thing I want to say just about the house is the front door. I do not understand the front door at all. Like you have to tell the front, you have to tell the computer to open the front door. You can't just open the front door. Like she earlier in the film, she just walks the front door. She says, open the front door, Alfred. And then the door like swings open. It's like, but why does it have a doorknob then? You know what I mean? Go all the way with it. Like,
yeah, it's wild. And like in the mail slot, Fritz Weaver's like, mail, Alfred, or Alfred, give me the mail. Yeah. Alfred, yeah. But like Alfred just like pushes out a drawer. Fritz still has to grab the mail. Alex, excuse me. Yeah. I think his character's name is Alex. Alex still has to like grab the mail. It's not, they didn't make it that convenient.
Anticipate email, even, you know, this early on, you know, maybe that you wouldn't have mail, you know. I guess, but then I was asking myself, is this movie, immediately I'm like, okay, this is in the future then, right? Like this movie is a futurist film. And I was sort of with that throughout the entire thing. I was like, this is a bad futurist movie, as in like they're not doing a good job of telling what the future is like because everybody's dressed like it's 1977 still. And then at the end, like right at the end, you find out, oh, it is 1977.
Yeah.
Which is really strange.
It is. And I don't know enough about cars to know if what Alex is driving is like,
it's a prototype, apparently. It's a of some car that came out like the next year.
Okay.
I read it. It was on IMDb.
It kind of reminded me of like a Firebird type deal, but I don't know.
It's like a Lamborghini or something, like a DeLorean, right? It's like the way the had wing doors, right?
I don't know, dude. I don't know anything about cars. Sorry.
Well, you've seen Back to the Future.
Yeah, but other cars have wing doors, like Teslas. Like
Lamborghinis.
So
I guess William Gibson, sci-fi author, like he has a quote, the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. It's like, you know, it's like that kind of thing kind of goes for a lot of like these kinds of, you know, like you take, you know, I don't know, like Escape from New York, you know, it's 1997, so it's like not, you know, super far in the future from when it was made, but you know, it's enough to where like, oh yeah, you know, in 10 years all this could happen. And
right, they're anticipating a lot more than what's actually going to happen. But I mean, this movie appears to be taking place in the year that it's made, and it's just that this guy is so brilliant that he's able to wire his entire house to do all these crazy things, and he had, for some reason he has a wheelchair with an arm attached to it, you know.
Yeah, and there's like
Joshua,
that one. Yeah, and who God knows what that was used for before the AI. I mean,
I don't even want to think about it, honestly.
Well, and he's got like the whole like construction zone downstairs where, or not the lab.
Yeah,
the lab is a better word for it. Sorry, construction zone. And the AI uses the lab to build like this giant like. I don't know, like a Rubik's Cube crane arm that
I called it a polygonal. Do you say polygonal or polygonal?
I say polygonal, but I don't know what's correct.
Like a Proteus polygonal shape.
Yeah.
And it can ends up in things.
It's like a sentinel of the basement. Defends the home.
This is the only thing that I thought was a genuinely interesting or potentially interesting visual in the film. of like the idea that of this floating polygon with that unfolds in different shapes depending and can like sort of, I was like, that's a cool idea. It's not executed super well because they do it all with puppetry. And it's like shaking constantly. Like it looks like it's hanging on wires, you know, which it is. But I, you know, it's like, that's a cool idea. Like I could see reading this book and being like, well, that's a cool idea, you know, visualizing it in your mind.
Yeah. And I thought it was cool and I thought it looked cool. But I would say that, my problems with this movie were not visual in nature. I thought a few things looked cool, and if there's some 70s, you know, strobe and light effects that I thought were nice. I thought that the insemination scene was very effective, the way that was filmed. But
effective in what way? Like it was like, horrifying to you?
Not horrifying so much as I just like the way that they shot it. Like with the, we have like the one sort of side profile angle of Christy, but we also have like the monitors. Like Christy is often framed with another monitor that gives us a different view of what's going on. Which is like, there's like an aerial shot and like other things like that. It was very clinical. In a way that I thought was good, but
stay on that scene just for a second. I think that like I didn't love the direction in the movie overall. Actually, like there's certain shots where I'm just like, I don't understand why you're shooting it this way. Like there's one shot where who's the guy who's like the lab assistant who gets killed by the polygon shape.
That guy
Garrett Graham, Gabler. So Gabler, when he shows up, there's like this shot of him looking at the house, but it's like from below him, and then he walks like down, you know, he's got to walk like, I don't know, I guess up a sidewalk or something to get to the house. And it like pans over. It's just really bizarre. I was like, what kind of a shot is this? It's like, it was like distracting, you know? And even like he randomly, they'll switch to like these weird wide angle lenses where like the whole image gets stretched, and it happens like 14 times throughout the movie, but it's like such a weird amount of that, and it doesn't seem to be corresponding to like the computer's vision or anything like that. It's just like, it just happens at random moments, it seems like.
I interpreted some of those as like we're trying to have the point of view from our binoculars cameras around.
Yeah, but right. Some of them, sure.
I think that you're right to say that it's not, that is not consistently deployed in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's why that some of that happens during that scene where she's being inseminated. And at that point also, it's like she's being inseminated with the gamete of a essentially an AI. And I was just like, this is a little bit too goofy to take seriously. Like I can't, I'm out of this movie at this point. Like I can't, like it's not for that reason. It's not effective for me when I'm watching, cause I'm just like, this is ridiculous, you know?
Yeah. And again, I love Christy so much, but it's hard to like, I have a hard time saying that she is like giving a bad performance, but what she is being asked to do and what she's being asked to react to is like so absurd.
It is.
And so it's like she is being asked to like react to being raped by a computer, and the computer is also a wheelchair with an arm. And it's a lot to ask. And it's a lot for us as a viewer to just accept. I have seen other movies where Christy is horrified and in pain, and she pulls it off much better than here. Kevin, what are your thoughts here? What are some general thoughts from you?
Well, general thoughts. So, like, one of the first things that I knew Fritz Weaver from was he's in a couple episodes of The Twilight Zone, and Robert Vaughn, the voice of Proteus, he's also in like an episode or two. And this thing, like, this movie is, like, so, like, it's very, very Twilight Zone. Like, the sort, the concept, the, like, there's a lot of, like that one episode, I Sing the Body Electric, where they have, like, you know, like, you can get a robot made or whatever. Like, that, like, you know, takes place, like, in the present day of, like, the early 60s. And yeah, it's like, I mean, it's certainly not alone in this, but this is just like a Twilight Zone episode with poor writing. And you know, it's longer than the average, Twilight Zone episode would be.
I mean, honestly, but, like, if you would cut out
some
of this and made it a 45-minute Twilight episode, I might be more with it.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I'd have less time to kind of get distracted by all of the nonsense present, since there is so much nonsense present. Yeah, I get that. Well, and I did not hate every visual decision, nor did I love every visual decision, but I definitely think, all right, so we're taking a goofy idea that might have worked as a Twilight episode. We're zhuzhing it up with, you know, some sunset shots and some camera angles, and what I actually thought was a really good score. I really like the score.
I didn't mind the score, and after reading about it, I have a little bit more respect for it. But, like, I don't know. It also, there are moments where it just feels like a generic, like, 70s horror score. Okay. Especially at the end, that the reveal at the end, not to jump to the end, but like the reveal at the end when the voice comes out of the kid and then there's that, like, the music stinger at that point, it was like, this is the worst music I've ever heard. it was so goofy, but, you know,
well,
that's one moment, so
regardless, it's like we have these sort of, like, you might call them art house or just like these seemingly like higher or elevated elements to this movie that is this ultimately like a, you know, like a 1950s B movie, a Twilight Zone episode. And it does not come together. And the good score and some of the visual stuff I think works definitely do not save it.
I agree. And I think the comparison to Twilight Zone is apt. Especially it's like such a contained story. It's like way more contained than I thought it was going to be. I didn't realize it was just going to be like sort of a, it's not a single location, but it is. I mean, it's most of it happens in that house between the computer and Christy. And I think it's also like really lopsided that way too. Like when the computer shows up in the house, it's in the house with Christy, I swear to God, for like 35 solid minutes, and you don't get back to the husband for a long
time. He disappears.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Which is just, I don't know. It's like, I was like, okay, this is not what I thought this movie was, because it feels like you're following him at first. And I was like, so, you know, I guess I'm not aware. I'm not, okay. For starters, I'm not the biggest Julie Christie fan in the world. I like McCabe and Mrs. Miller. You know what I mean? And I don't know. So, like, I'm not going into this movie being like, oh, this is a Julie Christie vehicle. Like, this is one of, you know, she's a huge star and this is one of her big movies, or, you know, an attempt at a big movie. I didn't even realize. I mean, I vaguely remember she had won an Oscar, but I didn't realize what it was for or when it happened. I was like, could have been after this for all I know. And so I was like, I don't know, like, you know, that this, I was when they show Fritz Weaver on the screen, I'm like, okay, this seems to be this guy's movie, and Julie Christie is going to be a, you know, supporting player or maybe a co-star, you know, like a, you know, co-lead. But it ends up being her film, which I don't have a huge issue with. It's just that it was just, you know, strange. And I don't think she's awful in it. I certainly don't think she's good, though. I don't think any of the actors are good in it. No good performances, but, you know, I think she's just doing what she can with what she's got. I agree with you. Like, I don't understand how she, like, what she's asked to do in this. I don't know how she agreed to do this.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know her personally, but it just feels insane that any self-respecting like, you know, classy lady like she appears to be would agree to be in like this sort of like schlocky, you know, like you say, Twilight Zone-y, which is like at in the 70s, Twilight Zone is not highbrow, right? I mean, it's like it's television, for God's sake.
Well, I mean, well, funny thing is, like, as campy and, you know, goofy as like some of the stuff in Twilight Zone could be and definitely was, like, they definitely had a lot more going on with the well, I hate to say, like, definitely some of the preachier things, like like, you know, stuff about like racism and war and, you know, man's inhumanity to man, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, I would definitely hold up a lot of their episodes way higher than some of the other things that kind of, you know, rip them off. Like, you know, yeah, I mean,
Night,
you know,
Night Gallery.
Well, Night Gallery was actually done by Rod Serling, so I don't know.
What ripped them off? Night Gallery. Like, what are we? What shows are you referring to? Like Black
Well,
Mirror.
Well, I'm gonna alienate all of our Criterion fans who listen. But Carnival of Souls is like pretty obviously like a like blatant ripoff, and it's like you know an hour and a half long, and it's like it literally like lifts a Twilight Zone storyline where this woman is actually dead, but she doesn't know it for like, you know, however long.
Spoiler.
And yeah, like that's something I just like people go on. It's like if you like if they put like Carnival of Souls on Criterion's Instagram, like people just come out of the woodwork. Greatest film ever made. So good. So great. So great. And I'm like, what are did we watch a different film?
Yeah, I don't
like
I've never really understood that kind of love for that movie.
But. Yeah. Be that as it may. Yeah, like. Yeah, I agree. Like, I definitely agree with the Christie stuff. It's like, lady, you were in Dr. Zhivago. Like, you know, like you've worked with David Lean, you've worked with Altman, you've worked with you know, Nicholas Regg. Like,
you will work. You will work with Kenneth Branagh one day. I mean, yeah, like, let's get it.
You're in a Harry Potter
John
film, McTiernan. God's sakes.
This wasn't like a slump. She wasn't as active throughout the 70s as she had been in the 60s. Like, she's always been relatively choosy, but like her 70s are The Go-Between, which is a favorite of mine. McCabe and Miss Miller, Don't Look Now, a favorite of mine. Shampoo, which is great. Nashville, which is great. Demon Seed stands out here. And then Heaven Can Wait, which was another huge hit with Warren Beatty. It's like,
So I was reading the trivia, and apparently when this came out, Warren Beatty said that he told her, he said, your career is over. Like, you ruined your entire career with this movie. And then he cast her in that movie the next year, Heaven Can Wait. And then according to the IMDb, she stopped, or she worked very, very intermittently after that. So I didn't look at the rest of her filmography. But
I mean, she was, I don't feel like she works less frequently than she did in the 70s. You know, she was making like a movie once every 2 years, two in 71, and then it's every other.
In the documentary about the making of The Hamlet, he claims he pulled her out of retirement. She claims she was in retirement, that she was not working anymore, and that he got her to be in Hamlet. I don't know how true that is either, but.
I mean, so he pulled her out of retirement, and then she was like, I'm going to do Dragonheart the same year.
I guess.
Now that I'm here.
I mean, yeah, maybe. Cause I did see, like, yeah, she was working, you know, more consistently after that. So maybe it just sort of, like, maybe learning all the Shakespeare lines lit a fire under her acting, gave her the acting bug again.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't there to know if it ruined her career, but it looks like she was just working less anyway.
Okay, about the visualizations again. I don't hate the so like when they impregnate her, which is essentially like a sex scene almost.
Or a rape scene.
Yeah, it's a rape scene, but it's like it's rape, yes. But she, I mean, she's agreed to do it, right? Not that she has any choice, I guess, but she could.
Yeah, I mean, she's agreed, like under duress. Under duress, so,
sure,
yeah.
Under duress, right.
Yeah.
I'm not arguing.
It's that or be tortured, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not arguing for the justice of it or anything. I'm just, you know. But it's not, it plays like a sex scene. It plays like a almost, you know, she's just lying there, and then it's like these weird close-ups. And then it cuts to this visualization of like a 1990s screensaver, which I thought for sure has to be computer generated imagery, right? Do you guys get that? I thought this is obviously CGI and it's got to be some of the earliest CGI in movies, and it's not in the IMDb trivia. And I was like, how is this not in the IMDb trivia if it is, you know?
Well, I mean, I know there's some like, there's like really like super early computer generated stuff in Westworld, which I want to say was like 73.
Yeah, that was early. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it could have been, but
it says I don't know. It says, maybe Vertigo actually has the, which is insane, the first feature film to use CGI as well as composition of live action film with CGI was Vertigo. That's on the Wikipedia for computer generated imagery.
That's insane.
Scenes?
No, it doesn't say anything about. Oh, it says. It says in the opening credits of the film.
Oh well, that's.
And it says the first feature film to use CGI with live action is Westworld, and other films that include CGI. Let's see, early films like Star Wars Episode 4. But see, like, does Star Wars have CGI in it?
Well, I mean, like,
I don't remember what that would be.
At this point, like, I think I know what they're getting at with Vertigo. Blasters. Like, in the title sequence, there's, like, a lot of, like, geometric, like, shapes and stuff. Sure. So, like, sure, like, a computer was probably capable of producing stuff like that they could, you know, Saul Bass could then film, but, like...
Yeah, but it's, exactly. It's, like, it's not actually producing the image, right? It's producing, producing the shape, and then he's, like, putting the shapes in order and photographing them. Like, that's not the same thing as what we're talking about.
So, yeah, and like episode 4, like I would like at that point I would probably be like, what is the definition of CGI? Right.
Yeah, I don't know, this is really confusing. It might even be referring to like the computers that they used for their like robotic arms that were doing the camera movements, you know, and all that stuff.
Maybe.
I don't even know. But anyway, I'm not going to read this whole page, obviously, right now. But anyways, I just thought it was weird. I was like, that you know, looks like CGI to me, but I don't know. Who knows what it actually is? Or maybe they did just animate it all. I don't know. Mm. The scene where... So after a while, she's been trapped in the house. The Proteus is torturing her and trying to get her to comply with his demands. And finally, Gabler shows up. Who you know is just disposable and is going to be killed, but he gets poor attacked guy. By the just wheelchair with the laser, which is pretty maybe the silliest moment in the film. And this is where the film just totally lost me. The slow mo of him turning the wheelchair over as like the heroic act. I was just like, why would you cut the slow mo here? It's so goofy, dude.
That was one of my notes as well.
Yeah.
It's like, we've got an action scene.
Yeah.
It was really, and then he really ducks cool. in and grabs the mirror so he can like deflect the laser, but like it's like not super effective.
I don't, you know.
Turns out in one of his 8,000 interviews for Rebel Moon Part 2, Zack Snyder says that's his favorite scene of all time.
Oh my
inspired
God.
His whole career.
Are you serious? Just,
no. Oh
my God. No. I thought you were serious.
Just like a very inappropriate slow-mo scene in the middle of it.
Okay, I see what you're saying. I thought you were saying he actually said, I love Demon Seed. It's one of my favorite films of all time.
I don't know. He is the kind of guy who would try to be a hero.
Oh, also, how does Proteus tie her up? Now, Proteus ties her up several times throughout this film. And I know what you're thinking. It's got to be this arm, this wheelchair arm, right? But you see that arm moving a lot. You see that hand moving a lot. And do you, you get the impression that that hand has the sort of fine motor skills to tie a knot?
Yeah, especially since it's one hand.
It's one hand also, and it moves like this. Like it's like it never, like barely can move. I mean, it's like, you know.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. There was other stuff in the lab that maybe could have helped, but I don't know. There, yeah. Since it seems like they're in the basement. Right. Does the polygonal crane arm?
No, it wasn't there though. It was still in the other room. Yeah. It hadn't bust out yet. Also, yeah. One thing that they do predict in this movie, deep fakes, right? So like
he creates
her vision of her. Although it's like an awful, I mean, it looks just like her, but it, you know, it's talking like a robot, so it's kind of weird.
Yeah. And then that fake video of the girl being killed. It's like, yeah, dude, oh, right. Like, like Proteus knows how to make, he knows how to make a movie.
she was not the best.
How annoying do you think it would be to have a house that every time somebody pulls up that says car in driveway, you think that would be a good thing? Like, would you want that?
Oh my God. Definitely not, especially if you were having a party.
Yeah, Alfred's voice is like the worst. I mean, at least Proteus has like a sort of nice, you know, I mean, it's ominous, but it's a normal voice. Like Alfred sounds so robotic, it's gross. I'd rather have like the original, you know, like old, like Windows 95 version of the, you know, a computer voice.
Oh boy. I don't ever want one of those like Ring camera things for my door, because I just, the idea that I would get constant notifications on my phone like stresses me out. I don't know. You could turn that off.
I mean, you don't have to have notifications.
I'm not on the Nextdoor app. I'm not so paranoid that someone's gonna steal my packages that I have to have a camera going all the time.
You guys are voracious readers. Are you big Dean Koontz fans?
Never read any of his stuff.
Never. Never will.
Will you read this one? No.
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 He apparently rewrote this in the 90s, I think. He wrote this in like 71 or something, and then he rewrote it in the 90s or maybe in the 2000s with like updated technology, and he changed a bunch of the characters and stuff, and you apparently can't find the original version of it anywhere. It's out of print.
Right, well, that's bullshit, that's... Dean.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. Yeah, he probably went to the theater, saw Lawnmower Man, and he was like, wait a minute, I gotta, I can't let this, like, I can't let this slide.
Julie Christie is nude in this, which I wasn't expecting.
You get a way better look at her in Don't Look Now, though.
All right, relax.
Well, I don't know if it's true. On his Criterion visit, Edgar Wright says there's a story of like apparently Warren Beatty, who is married to Julie Christie, like he was so convinced that it was the sex scene in Don't Look Now was like real that he was like trying to have the movie like buried, because like he's like, I don't want a movie of somebody else fucking my wife out there.
He knew what it was like to have sex with her, and he's like, that's the sound she makes when we have sex. Wait a
minute. Yeah.
it's just her using her memory to be a good actor, you know.
That's right.
Some lines that I think could have been effective in a movie with a different tone, like if we'd taken a different tact here. I really like when Proteus, like in that kind of first conversation, or maybe second conversation with Alex in the bunker, where he's like thinking about the tasks he is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And one of his arguments is like, I am reason. Alex was like, see reason. And he's like, I am reason. Like,
yeah.
That's good. That's also a moment where we shut that fucking AI down. AI says, yeah. I am reason. It's over.
Well, like even like the very first scene when like, you know, the investors or whoever like show up and like, we want to talk to Proteus. And he's like, And, you know, like, you know, Proteus, tell us the blah, blah, blah. He's like, why? What do you it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Like, nothing means anything. Like, what? Get out of my face.
I wrote down a line of dialogue that I don't know who said it anymore. I don't remember the context. But someone or something says, I am not a motorcycle.
Don't remember that one, and I just watched this 2 hours ago, so I don't. Okay.
And then last one, I really like when he tells Susan, make yourself presentable, Susan. I have not had time to brainwash you.
Yeah.
You like that, huh?
I did like that.
Yeah, I mean, the I am reason line, I agree, might work in a film that was that you could take more seriously, you know, because it's obviously supposed to have weight, that line, and it does not in this movie. But
well, there is there's a review on Letterboxd that claims that this was originally envisioned as like a dark comedy.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, the brainwashing line kind of sounds like it came from that draft.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
What'd you guys think about the ending?
That was something else.
They break the child out of the incubator, and it's their child.
Yeah.
The first of two twists.
Yeah.
One of my notes was like, I am so surprised they've like committed to showing sort of like the robot child. And I was like, oh, damn. Okay. That's just the shell.
Mm.
Honestly, it being the shell is the only thing that saves that whole idea. Like, the robot child is so goofy. Like, it's ridiculous looking coming out of the thing. And I'm just like, are they serious with this? Like, this is brutal. And then when they start to peel the shell, it's like, okay, well, at least it's not actually like a robot baby. It's like a thing that's, I guess, incubating the baby within the larger incubator. And the fact that it's their kid, it might have been a cool idea if they had, like, you know, it's like if they're trying to insinuate like the AI is making the child look that way so that it's easier for them to love it or something. But all that sort of, you know, I don't know. It's not explained at all.
I think that's like a missed opportunity thing for me, where it's like, all right, so ultimately, this movie isn't saying much or anything. It's like, we had a scenario where, like, you could have tried to say something about, you know, American marriages or tech and fear of technology and like how that infiltrates the home or something. But instead, you send Alex away for the entire goddamn movie until he like suddenly realizes with 12 minutes left that, like, oh shit, my wife.
Yeah.
And like goes, my back wife to the hasn't house.
Killed me in 2 months. I guess I gotta get over there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think it is saying something about drilling for cobalt at the bottom of the sea. I mean, it's against that. It's anti-cobalt mining.
Our psychotic AI that wants to procreate tells us hugger. That's bad. So
yeah.
He doesn't want to rape the earth, he says, right? I don't know. I can't help you. I can't assist you raping the earth. But he will rape his wife. So it's a little bit of a double standard for Proteus.
So it is Proteus who says, I am not a motorcycle.
When does he say that?
He says it. I found a transcript. It's transcript of just the things Proteus says online.
Oh my God.
Oh, wow.
My analysis of your metabolism indicates 7:40 a.m. as the optimum time for your morning fuel ingestion.
I remember him saying
this
that.
This would have been one of the times where she probably, like, this is probably when she throws the food.
Eggs on the
or
thing.
Something.
Yeah.
His next line is, I am not a motorcycle. And then his line after that is, your refusal to speak to me is tediously immature, Susan.
Why does he say, I am not a motorcycle?
There must have been a visual there of some sort where she tries to rev something up. I don't know.
I do not remember that. I remember every other line you just said except for that one.
I wrote
it down.
I have
to rewatch this now. Just that one scene, though, not the entire thing, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
I did get Scanner vibes from the very end.
I can see
similar
that.
To the ending of Scanners, where there's this body switch thing, you know, when his voice comes out of the girl, it sounded, it was just like the ending of Scanners to me.
Yeah. But that, so the ending where Alex comes back, and when Alex gets in, I was like, oh no. Like, cause, Julie Christie seems to have gone like full Stockholm with her Stockholm syndrome with her pregnancy. Like she's mm-hmm. not immediately like freaking out or angry or anything. She just kind of welcomes Alex in. And that could be because she also knows that the robot can kill them any moment. But, and Alex is freaking out and trying to shut Proteus down and things like that. And then it flips. Like once they've kind of broken into the incubator, Christy looks inside and is like, fuck this. We got to kill this thing right now. And Alex is like, hold on, hear me out.
Pump the brakes.
And so I like that little flip. But I didn't like that once the child is out and they're peeling the shell away, they're both like, all right, this is our kid now. Except that kid clearly has the fucking robot voice. Like,
yeah. Like, how are you going to raise that kid?
Yeah. The robot voice ruins the whole, we're going to just accept this kid concept.
Also, like, how does she have that voice? You know what I mean? Like, how are her vocal cords producing that noise?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm alive. That's
the part of the biology that doesn't make sense to you.
Yeah. Well, of course. Yeah. But anyway. I'm out of notes for this thing.
Yeah.
Ratings? Unless JR has more to say. JR, you have more to say?
No, I think we're okay.
Yeah. Well, sorry, I'm going 2.5 on this one.
JR?
I'm going to go 4.25.
No, you're not.
You're right. I'm going 2.5.
Okay. I was a 2.5 until the last 15 or 20 minutes. I'm a 2. This is brutal. That's not a good movie at all.
Sorry, guys. Sorry. Good, man.
Hey, you know what? I watched worse since the last episode. So.
Well, and the good news is that I didn't like pick something I knew I loved so much and had to like defend it to you guys. No.
No, so totally.
It's bad all around.
You had seen this before or not?
I had seen it before.
Did you remember liking it, or?
I did remember liking it.
Oh.
I did not like it this time. Yikes. I don't know. I mean, I do know what I liked. I liked, I think I just liked the attempts at style. Oh,
sorry. I mean, you're younger, you know, you might.
Yeah, I think the score and like sort of the quiet spare, feel or vibe. I don't know. I think that stuff, and maybe I found the story more interesting back then. Who knows? I was wrong. I was dumb.
That's all good. Let's, are we doing roulette with this movie?
Let's do roulette. We got.
Sure.
I think JR's a shoo-in for this, but I was looking at Julie Christie's filmography earlier, and I have seen like at least 4 movies that JR has not seen. But.
You've seen Red Riding Hood?
No.
You've seen Hamlet?
Yes. Hang on, I can't
You've probably seen The Secret Life of Words for some reason.
Looking movie. No, I've never seen that one. Hang on, I'll tell you what I've seen that you haven't. Have you seen New York, I Love You? Because I have.
Yeah.
No, you haven't.
Yeah, I have.
You have not lost
it? No. Well, sorry, that's not New York, New York. New York, I Love You. No, why would I ever watch this?
I also saw The Company You Keep with... Robert Redford, directed by Robert Redford. I saw that in the theater in 2012 with Shia LaBeouf.
That's a weird choice. And
I saw The Miracle Maker, which is a claymation Jesus movie.
Okay, and I would say weird choice, but I know your past.
And I saw A Decade Under the Influence, the Ted Demme documentary.
Yeah, I've never seen any of those piles of garbage. Why would I?
Hey.
I don't know if The Decade Under the Influence is good or not.
I don't remember. I'm sure it's great. It might be okay. Ted Demme's not the best director, but you know, but then you've seen things like Dr. Zhivago, which I haven't, Heaven Can Wait, and Shampoo and Darling and all these other
fantasy. Yeah, those all those real movies.
Yeah, so I mean, you're probably gonna kick my ass in this.
But it doesn't have to be Kevin Christy.
No, it doesn't have to be, but I mean, the rest of these guys I know you're going to beat me with.
I would not assume that.
I would. Well, we can go ahead and try it. Let's see. So our actors are Julie Christie, Fritz Weaver, Garrett Graham, Barry Kroger, and Lisa Liu, and Larry Blake. Who the fuck is Larry Blake?
Some bloke.
Is he like one of the boss?
He's the old guy who makes him shut the computer down at the end.
Suit. Okay. Mm. Okay. Hold on.
Yeah.
If we don't want to do roulette, we could do the Vulture Cinematrix today.
Well, you lost that.
I did. Yes.
What are you just you throwing yourself on your sword?
I mean, I don't mean to throw myself on the sword so much as I, you know, if you think this is already rigged,
I don't think it's rigged.
Then
I don't think it's rigged. I'll tell you what, if you want to use Vulture, we can use Vulture. I'd still like to know your Christie number though.
All right, I'm taking the loss.
Okay, so
Vulture.
I thought the Gray Man would count as a Ryan Gosling movie that has a character name in the title. It doesn't. The Gray Man is not his name. I just couldn't think.
I don't even know. Is the Gray Man even referring to him, or is it the villain?
I can't remember. That movie didn't make any fucking sense.
Right. All right. Well, what's your Christie number?
My Christie number is 23.
Fuck. Yeah, you'd have beat me by 10, bro. I got 13. I mean, you know, it is what it is. You're a Christie fan. I said it earlier. I'm not the biggest Christie fan. What's your number, Kevin?
10.
Yeah, so it's, you know, that's a normal amount, Kevin. You and I have normal amounts of Christie in our lives.
Okay. All right. You guys have never seen Shampoo or Petulia or Darling, so Billy Liar, and those are all wonderful. The Go Between is also on my deep dive list. That's a Joseph Losey movie. That's what I should have just done, because
you lucked out, bud. We've got a 5-minute short as our pick.
You're kidding.
Homework. I'm not kidding. It's called Now. It's from 1965. Oh, you've seen this. Oh, fuck. No, you haven't. Never mind. That's somebody else. You've changed your image on Letterboxd. And it looks very similar to somebody else I follow.
I have?
Didn't you?
Yeah, Stalker.
You used to have a picture of you, and now it's...
The picture of me was just, like, so old. I was like...
Right. Yeah.
It's like, I think it was in high school for that picture. I was like, I gotta get rid of this.
Anyways, this movie's called Now. It's got an exclamation point at the end. It's directed by Santiago Alvarez. And it uses morgue photos, newsreel footage, and recordings of Lena Horne.
Okay.
To make powerful bursts of propaganda. It's only 5 minutes. I'll fucking watch this shit too.
Love propaganda.
Yeah, man.
Feed me all of it.
Santiago Alvarez is, but oh, he directed 79 Springs. I have this on my Plex. I've been meaning to watch this actually. It's about Ho Chi Minh. Anyway, he seems like a pretty leftist filmmaker. This guy. He's got a Che thing on here. This guy is a. Bit of a commie, this guy. Anyway,
yes, Cuban.
So yeah, you win. You got to watch a five-minute movie. I don't know if Kevin. I don't know what the rules were last time. Kevin, were you supposed to watch To the Wonder with me or no?
I was supposed to. I started it.
Yeah.
I got bored. I didn't finish it.
How far did you get?
Like half an hour in.
Okay, I got an hour in before we started recording. Yeah, I got an hour in, and I've seen it. I didn't stop it. I was just super tired. I had to like close my eyes. I like this movie. I'm not bored by it exactly. Although I can see why you would be, because more so than any other Malick film that I've seen, this is. He's going all in on the montage thing. Like there are no scenes in this movie. It's all montage. It's very like Spring Breakers ish almost. It's like edited that way, except not as frenetic, obviously, but it's like, there are no scenes, you know, it's not stop cutting. Nobody's talking to each other. There's weird, like voiceover and stuff. And, but then there's like these little like punctuations of exposition where you understand that Ben Affleck no longer gets along with Olga Kurylenko and that she wants to move back to Paris. You know, it's interesting how he does it. Actually, it's like it's pretty impressive because he somehow manages to have a very like concrete story going where you can follow it pretty easily.
Yeah,
it's just that, like nothing's actually happening. It's like really, it's really yeah. strange. And
Ben Affleck two people has, in a frame not looking at each other.
Well, all and the time. More than that, he's obsessed with the women. He barely shoots Affleck at all. You never see Affleck's face for like the first 20 minutes of the movie. It's just Kurylenko like blocking his face. It's just on Kurylenko with like the back of Affleck's head. He doesn't talk ever. Like, you know, until they get back to America, he talks you know, briefly every now and then. And even like during like they have these again, it's just all montage, but they have like these the montages of their fighting, you know, they're sort of falling out. And even that's happening like sort of in silence. You don't hear any of that. It's just this like orchestral swelling music over it. And then there's these strange non sequiturs to the parish priest played by Javier Bardem, whose church they attend. Actually all three of them. So it's like a love triangle sort of. That's Affleck, Kurylenko and Rachel McAdams. And Javier Bardem is like struggling with his faith and he doesn't, I can't know God. How can I know you? You know, that kind of thing. But again, not talking to anyone, just in voiceover prayers to God. Which I you know, any other filmmaker, I would say, well, that is really some pretentious bullshit, but somehow it sort of works in this case, in my opinion. I don't know. Maybe it's because it's Javier Bardem too. He's got weight as an actor. You know, you believe it. And there are really cool moments where some of these actors are conversing with complete non-actors, like real people, which is really cool. I think that's really interesting. Sort of reminded me of in Mr. Nobody, the Harmony Korine film, Herzog talks to that one person as a priest, like he's in character as the priest, and I think he like blesses the person even, and like the person thinks, just like you get the impression that the person thinks he's a real priest. So it's a little morally shaky, but it's really interesting anyway. So yeah, this I don't know.
Did you guys, either of you, see Knight of Cups, the Christian Bale Terrence Malick movie?
I haven't.
Okay. I thought that is a similar style, but like it's going even further, which like with the montage, and I hated it.
I did not like Knight of Cups nearly as much as I liked this movie when I first saw it, and I gave it a 3. I can't believe I gave it a 3 actually, but yeah, I could see that. Knight of Cups is what sort of. I stopped watching his stuff. You know, I never saw Song to Song. But then when Hidden Life came out, I was excited about that. It seemed more of a return to form, although it's similar in a lot of ways, I guess. But
did you not watch Hidden Life?
I did. I liked it.
Okay,
yeah, I liked Hidden Life.
I think Hidden Life is a little bit more traditional in its storytelling.
No, it's more traditional of a story, I think. It's and it's not nearly as montage-y, but it is. I mean, he's still doing the same sort of like from a new world on, that sort of, even in Thin Red Line, he does this too. Just like sky shots, everything's epic. Everything's like existence, you know? Oh my God.
Yeah.
You know?
I think of Tree of Life as the true like starting point of the style. I think there was always, that was always it. Or not always. It was there, as you said, in A New World and, in Thin Red Line, but he really pushed into it. I forgot about Song to Song. Apparently I dislike Song to Song even more than Knight of Cups.
Yeah,
I completely erased that from my brain.
I was like so not interested in this movie when it I think I used this as my 2-hour Gosling movie today in Vulture, actually.
Oh.
But
I could not have given you. You tell me Song to Song, Terrence Malick movie, 2017. You could have given me like one actor, like say Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
And like I could not have given you any other details. I was like,
I just remember I could have told you it was in a set in Austin, because I remember when this movie was being shot, because it was like, oh my god, he's shooting another movie already. Like, Knight of Cups isn't even out, and he's already shooting. So he never shoots shit, you know. And then it was like there was all these pictures of Austin City Limits. He was shooting at Austin City Limits, like certain scenes of it.
Yeah,
it's all over Pitchfork, you know.
I mean, in 2015, it was like, oh, I guess he's like never gonna leave Texas again.
Right.
But he did.
I'm super psyched for Way of the Wind. You know, what can I say? I'm very, very excited.
You know, we need more Jesus.
We need more. If it's directed by Malick, we need Jesus. I don't know.
You know? I mean,
or Scorsese.
Well, yeah, Malick. Yeah, Malick and Scorsese are like the two dudes where it's like, all right, you know, I'm not really into Jesus stuff, but right. It's okay that you are.
I don't know. Do you get the impression that Malick is a Christian? I don't know about that.
I have gotten that impression, and I think I got that impression from Tree of Life.
Really? Just because of the afterlife stuff in it?
I thought all the like the afterlife heaven-y stuff was pretty Christian-y. Felt Christian-y to me.
That's fair, I guess.
Christian-ish.
I didn't read that into it, but I mean, it's obviously there. I just didn't, you know, I was like raging against that at the time. So, I don't know. I know he was like a huge, like, philosophy nerd in college. He was like a doctorate in philosophy or something when he was in college. So maybe it was a religious philosophy. I don't know. But anyway, enough about Malick. To the Wonder, I will finish this movie, the rewatch of this movie. I am enjoying it. I don't think I'll be at the 4.5 that I was the last time I watched it. I don't. This was 8 years ago when I saw this movie last, so who knows. I would still like to see Malick's very first short film, Lanton Mills, which is a Western starring Harry Dean Stanton, which is apparently lost.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, so I don't know.
So you won't see it.
It says, like, this guy says, the American Film Institute has sole ownership of the short for whatever reason.
Is that one of those, like,
there's no way to access it.
God damn it. That's like one of the, there's like one of the earliest Best Picture nominees, like Academy Award Best Picture nominees, is like, there's one copy and some film museum in Los Angeles has it, and they host private screenings occasionally, but otherwise you can't see it. And it's like,
what is
can't
the
you
point?
Guys fucking restore it? Can't you?
Yeah, right.
Can't you do something?
Why would you have, if they have one copy, you're saying they have a print of it? They don't show the print though, right? They've obviously scanned the print.
I would think so, but I don't know.
There could be showing like a 100-year-old print at the
that thing would light up so fast
in private screening. I mean, I just wouldn't think they'd risk that, you know, if they only have the one copy. Oh, this also has Warren Oates in it, by the way, Lanton Mills. But
oh my god,
so you'll give never that see to that. Me. Yeah.
Shit, man.
Yeah. So, anyway, what did you guys watch?
So this afternoon I watched Unfrosted, the Pop-Tart story, Jerry Seinfeld's new film.
I forgot that was this weekend. Okay.
Yeah. I think I can say with absolute confidence, if John watches this, he will hate every solitary second of it. It's goofy for the sake of goofy, and like, you know, it's not obviously, you know, it's goofy because it's a comedy, but like, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, winks to like historical things, and you know, in the most goofy fashion. So I think John would not enjoy this, but you know, if I'm not going to tell him to not watch it, it's his life.
I you don't have to tell me. I will not watch this.
Okay.
Not interested.
Yeah.
I don't know. Seinfeld is like, I don't think Jerry Seinfeld is a funny person anymore, quite frankly. And I mean, that's just for me. I like his last stand-up special was like unbearable. I couldn't finish it. And, he, some of the, I don't know, his comments are just really like, they're increasingly like more like, you know, old man right wing stuff. I'm just not into it. And then like this movie just looks ridiculous to me. But I, you know, it's just not my thing. I just don't have time. You know, I got other stuff I'm trying to get through.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. You know, like I didn't take it seriously. Which mm-hmm. like looking at the reviews on Letterboxd of this, it's like, y'all, like, what did you come to this movie expecting to see?
Well, it's like, his fault.
Well, I guess, but
he made his like Hollywood is dead comments and stuff.
Yeah,
and all that shit right before his movie came out, and so now people are gonna.
Which is fine. I actually don't disagree.
Coming hot.
His comments about that are like, that's fine. I mean, movies are dead. I mean, he's right about that. I don't know what his point is in saying that and coming out with a movie in the same time. But
yeah.
But yeah, it's just really strange to me. Like Seinfeld's like, he's so bizarre because like what he's made two movies now.
Yeah.
In like 20 years, and the first one that he made was animated, which was bizarre. You know. And, like, you remember he dressed as a bee to promote it at Cannes? At the Cannes Film Festival? He's promoting this children's animated movie. It was just so strange. And then, like, I want to say that wasn't a big hit. And now, it's like, all these years later...
huge with my eighth graders. Like,
no shit.
My middle schoolers fucking love B-movie.
Yeah.
And I'm always... I've never seen it.
Yeah. And, I mean, like... I just watched a podcast with him just the other day, and like it makes 100% sense for him to go to Cannes dressed as a bee, because, and I think you know, as much as we, you know, have a different idea of what, you know, movies, films, cinema, what that is, mm-hmm. I think we can all agree that places like Cannes or, you know, TIFF or whatever else, like, these places get so far up their own asses, and it's like, guys, like, you know, like, you know, you're not solving world hunger with your, you know, performance, or, you know, like, your camera angles aren't, you know, bringing world peace. It's a movie at the end of the day. Like, yes, it can, you know, it can build people up. It can, you know, do all these wonderful things, but it's a movie.
I just shared with you the video of him doing this at Cannes Film Festival.
But the opening film at Cannes is like always a blockbuster. Like, like fucking the Last Indiana Jones movie opened Cannes, and like he might have been there because B movie was playing Cannes. You know, like,
yeah, fair enough. I mean, it's
they're up their own butts, but they also like love showing American money because they want the American money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah,
it would have been weird to do in LA for the premiere, in my opinion, but you know,
probably.
Weirder still at Cannes.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway. JR?
Sure. I also have a modern cinematic classic from this year. I watched Night Swim, the horror film released in January with Wyatt Russell, Kurt Russell's son. And, you know, if you thought an AI impregnating a woman was unrealistic and hard to take serious, then try the haunted fucking swimming pool that is fed with like a wellspring. Like the pool is not like it's water pipes. It's just like spring fed. There we go. But it's an old like Indian burial site or something. And
do they know that it's haunted fed with a spring?
They learn that it's fed with a spring pretty early on.
Is that, and they think that's okay?
Yeah. Apparently that is...
that is okay?
yeah. Apparently that is a thing that can happen. Or that you they can set up. But I don't think it would be common now. Most people don't have springs on their property. But, yeah, man, this was... this was rough. And it was rough from the very beginning, where some entity or thing just like seems to drown a small child, a little girl. And just Wyatt Russell's like this injured professional baseball player. You know, he's a third baseman for the Minnesota Twins. And the pool gives him like healing properties, and he's like, he's getting better. He's rehabbing. He's like becomes obsessed with trying to get back into the game, you know, all the while his son is his little loser of a son. He's presented as like this, like a dweeby kid who wants to be athletic like his dad, but just is tiny and uncoordinated. And it becomes clear that the pool is trying to take the son, kill him. So it turns out the pool does have these like healing properties, but it exacts a cost. You have to sacrifice a person to get the good stuff from the pool. And that's the story. And there's nothing scary about it at all. Except for sometimes when people just hold their breath for like 3 minutes at a time. That scares me. It's like, what are you doing? Go. It's 6 feet deep. Go up for air. Go up for air. I can't hear John.
Or like I was saying, when you check how much time is left on it, that might be scary. You know, like, oh my God, yeah. I got 20 minutes left of this. No, shit.
I mean, it's like an hour 45 too. Like you can't be doing a haunted pool for an hour 45. That's 83. That's 83 minutes tops.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark? Oh, it has like an actual like creature that is living in the pool. But like, yeah, I mean, yeah. That was like half an hour. So been there, done that.
OK, I watched Miller's Girl. Going, just keeping along with the bad movies that we've been watching. This is directed by Jade Halle Bartlett, who has not directed anything. This is her debut, and it stars Martin Freeman and the It Girl of 2023, Jenna Ortega, as Cairo Sweet. Her name is Cairo Sweet.
Cairo.
And she's a precocious high school student of questionable age. Who knows what grade she's in? Who knows how old she is? They don't explain any of that. And she goes to they make a point to say this is a public high school, but God, if it doesn't look like a like Oxford level college, like the classroom that this guy teaches in, it's like he's teaching English, Martin Freeman's character, or literature or whatever. And, you know, they have like tables. Of course, the kids are in whatever they wear, whatever they want. And there's these everything's oak and, you know, these big windows like letting in light. There's no lights turned on. Everything's naturally lit, of course. And there's like a fireplace in the corner of the room. Anyway.
Fuck. Wait, is this in the UK? Where is it supposed to be?
It's in Tennessee. It's supposed to be in Tennessee, in the middle of nowhere, some random town that she's just dying to get out of. She's never been anywhere, and she's just got to get out. Her mind is too big for this place. And yeah. So, anyways, if you've seen the trailer for this movie, it is exactly what it looks like. This fellow Martin Freeman is attracted to this young girl, and she is attracted to him. And they don't have as much of an affair as the trailer might lead you to believe, but they do inappropriate things with each other. I mean, just starting with the fact that like he goes to a poetry reading and invites her along. So like I just meeting with an underage kid outside of school to begin with, especially a girl and a guy, I don't know, just feels very, very wrong and icky. And they are sitting very close to each other on a love seat. And I don't know. It's very bizarre. And then later on, he goes to her house while she's alone by himself and it's raining. And then there's some questionable contact at that point. And then he gets in trouble.
Like this. Yeah.
He gets in trouble for it. This movie is really bad, like really poorly written, overwritten as fuck. Beyond the fact, beyond just like what you would imagine like, okay, there is no high school girl that is like Jenna Ortega in this movie, who is, you know, she's reading Henry Miller. She's read, Finnegan's Wake. She's just brilliant. Oh my God. She's so smart. They literally, I mean, these are literal books that she's read and she talks about in this movie. And he's just so bowled over by this, you know, that, she's a, you know, a fan of James Joyce and Henry Miller. And he allows her to, you know, write things that are like in the style of Henry Miller, and that gets him in trouble too, because obviously Henry Miller's, you know, sexual, very, very sexual. And yeah, and it's just really bad and overwritten. The only redeeming quality of this movie, I think, is Martin Freeman's performance, which is like not awful. Everyone else in this movie is pretty bad, especially Ortega. And I don't know, for some reason, like I want to like Ortega, man, but she's so bad in this. I don't know. And she's just not in anything good. Everything she's in is shit.
She had that other like teen movie that you really hated. The
Fallout? Yeah, that was a zero. But that had nothing redeeming about it. But these are similar movies in that they're just like, they're attempting to get at something that's like really important about what like teens go through. But it's just so vapid and like not getting at it at all. It's so superficial, you know.
And do teens really go through this?
I mean, if you've been through a school shooting, I guess yeah, you get depressed maybe. Well, but it's like
I didn't mean the Fallout. Didn't mean the Fallout. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Oh well, I mean, do teens go through being attracted to the faculty members? I don't know. Some of them do.
Maybe. And like I do know that. Yeah. I mean, obviously there are teachers getting caught.
Sure.
Not infrequently, like for this kind of crime.
Mostly women, though, to be fair.
It is, which is, I don't know, interesting to me. It definitely seems strange. Like it would be a thing awful men mm-hmm. commit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't seem like this would be like a universal teen experience of like the reciprocated attraction. Oh,
definitely not. Definitely not. And I mean, there's other things going on with Cairo Sweet. I mean, her parents have essentially abandoned her to like vacation in Europe, so they're gone, and she's left in this gigantic vacant mansion by herself, like this gothic, you know, Tennessee mansion in the in the Spanish moss everywhere.
Someone get this actress away from Timothy Burton.
I know. It felt very like a like bad short fiction, you know, like just like the kind of stuff that like I'm like
Netflix called Burton is like, can we use the Wednesday set?
I know. I'm like, I'm tenuously in this short fiction workshop thing that Jordan set up a long time ago, and Jordan's not involved mm-hmm. with it anymore, and they still send me the emails of the stories, and I read the stories, and they're just always awful. Like, and it's just this reminds me of one of their stories. It's just like this goofy, like, had to have started as, you know, fan fiction for some, you know, YA stuff that they're into, and it's just bloomed into this. It's just gross. It's not good at all. So
that's the problem, like with teaching English and having them write their own stories. You have to read them.
Do you do that? You have your kids write narrative?
They write one narrative this year. It's just like one of the standards.
So we
do it.
We have that standard, but I don't make them do that. We haven't. That's not part of our curriculum. It's not in the textbook. So, but
that's great for you.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, my kids are seniors. Some of them would probably write maybe okay stuff. Some of them, but I have like 130 kids, so I'm sure I get a lot of shit too.
Yeah,
it's brutal. I thought about starting a writing club, but I won't, you know, because I know what it's like. You know, I know what these, especially the kids who think they can write. Those are the worst ones.
Are you required to like sponsor a club?
No, in EBR, I was. Were you required to have a club at your school in EBR?
Yeah. They started clubs my second year there, and they were like, "Think of a club," and I didn't think of a club, but the band teacher wanted to do an anime club and asked if I would do that with him. And I was like, sure.
We had to do clubs because the clubs were like, they would change the whole schedule and they were during second period or something. You know? So
were you at a high school or a middle school?
No, this is at middle school. But at Zachary, the clubs are all after school, so it's totally up to you what you want to do. Like, in fact, the magic club that I do now, I'm not doing anymore after this year because the other teacher is co-sponsoring it quit. So I'm not going to do it by myself. The only reason I even did it was to play magic with this guy, and now he's gone. So I'm not playing magic with a bunch of kids.
I know in my current district, if you do a club, you get like a little stipend thing. But
go fuck yourself. Are you fucking serious? A stipend?
Yeah.
For a club?
Yeah.
Such bullshit. I'd do 5 clubs if I got a stipend.
Well, they won't let you do 5, but yeah.
Oh, well.
Mm.
I would definitely do one if I got a stipend. They don't offer anything here. In fact, you have to beg them to let you do a club, and then you do it, and then they forget about you. They don't ask any questions, but... certainly no stipend, for God's sake. I've been tutoring a lot lately, though, so getting that extra cash that way. Oh, yeah. Word. Anyway, that's it for Miller's Girl. It's trash. Watch Oleana instead. David Mamet's Oleana is great.
I never seen that.
You should. It's on my deep dive list, so maybe at some point I'll. I've already rarely, and hold me to it, okay? I've already chosen my next deep dive for next episode that I'm gonna, where it's my pick next episode.
Okay.
It is my pick next episode, right?
If you say so, yeah.
I'm going, because it's Kevin's this episode. So I'm going to, have the pick in mind. I know exactly what I'm going to pick. So just remind me that I said that, okay?
I'll try so hard to remind you.
Yeah, okay. All right, go ahead. Kevin?
All right. Real quick, I went back and watched a bunch of stuff that I was like, I really loved this when I first saw it, so now it's time to see if it's still any good. And I'm happy to report Death of Stalin, Sunset Boulevard, A Town Called Panic, and Monsieur Hulot's Holiday still stand at 5 stars. They're all fucking great. I love them.
Yeah, dude.
The last like half hour of A Town Called Panic, the boys sat and watched it with me, and they were laughing their asses off. I mean, it's very slapsticky at that point, but I was surprised too, because like Sebastian was like, I mean, he was reading them out loud, but like he was going with the subtitles, and like that didn't seem to bother him so much. So I was like, all right,
it's great. You got to get that subtitle training in early.
Yeah, for sure.
So many people grow up unable to handle subtitles.
Yeah, and,
that's not acceptable.
Exactly. But yeah, so that was really nice to see how that many things still held up over, you know, however many years. I mean, Panic and Holiday, like those were like, you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. But like Sunset Boulevard and Death of Stalin, like those were like at least 5 years ago now. So. Yeah, great movies.
All right, JR.
Cool. I won't have a great movie. I watched Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. Because I am pretty sure Aquaman, like the first Aquaman, is like the best DCEU movie. Like, I don't know if I'm kidding. It might be.
Well, that's the one. I think that's generally agreed. That and Wonder Woman are the ones everybody likes, right?
Yeah,
Man,
I think
Man like, of Steel, maybe. I don't know.
The I thought I would check it out. I had the Blu-ray from the library. It's like one of the rare superhero movies that is like not trying to be over 2 hours. So, watched it, and it's like it's fine. It, you know, for some reason, James Wan took from his time on the Fast and Furious franchise, like never let the villains of the previous movie go, just bring him back as the good guys in the next one. So like,
nice.
Patrick Wilson, who is Aquaman's brother, was the villain of the first movie. He's back, and he's got to help Aquaman save the world this time.
It sounds suspiciously like Thor.
I don't know.
Kinda. And isn't Aquaman a bit of a literal fish out of water?
Oh,
does he leave the sea and like become a man and like have trouble adjusting at all?
No, this version of Aquaman has spent his life on land. He's the fish out of water when he's in the water. Like, he's not an except, like, he's the king down there now in Atlantis, and he is not liked because he was raised on land and
I see.
And cares for humans. Anyway, that's all nonsense. But the and this movie is mostly nonsense. I thought this movie was not awful. It's sort of like a, you know, like a buddy cop kind of dynamic that that Aquaman and his brother have, and they're not awful together. And there's a lot of like very clear like 50s B movie inspiration that, you know, like I see like a lot of bad CGI and silliness, but then I'm also seeing things that like I recognize from like those old like Italian movies about Greek gods and stuff, and like, and just, you know, it seems intentional. Maybe it's not, but it felt intentional. And you know, it's just the silliness was not offensive to me. You know, I don't recommend it. It's a waste of time, but as far as a waste of time goes, it was enjoyable.
Yeah, I won't watch this one either. Yeah. I mean, beyond
none
the fact
of us
that
should watch what the things that we're talking about, absolutely, except for the things that Kevin just mentioned. Those are good movies.
But the beyond the fact that you know, the DC movies, like that movie it's a dead story, right? It's like, I mean, it's not, they're not going forward with any of that. So it's pointless, completely pointless to watch from that perspective as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's in, yeah, because you care so much about like superhero continuity.
I'm sure some people do. So I'm not saying that's not the reason I'm watching it. I'm not watching it because I don't like that. And I really don't like Momoa. So,
yeah, there's a lot of him there. Yeah, I wouldn't.
Yeah. Not interested, bud. Not interested. All right. Well, I watched Late Night with the Devil, so you don't have to. This is directed by Cameron and Colin Cairns.
But I will. I will watch this one. God damn it.
So this is a example of like a pretty interesting and good idea that is just botched in execution. And starting from the premise of, okay, this movie is cobbled together from found footage of this broadcast that they did this one night back in 1977, the same year Demon Seed came out. Coincidence? Anyway, and it's also behind the scenes footage, which, you know, I there has to be a little bit of believability, right? Like, I'm pretty sure they weren't shooting behind the scenes footage a lot for, like, you know, late night shows in the 70s. I don't know.
Yeah.
And they certainly weren't shooting it in like Verite black and white, you know, it's like you know, and they certainly weren't shooting things like the late night host, you know, smoking backstage, talking about his affairs with other women, talking, you know, using the F word, things like this. You know, he has an image to maintain, obviously. And I know they smoked on the show. He's not smoking on the show. He's making a very conscious effort to smoke backstage when they're on commercial, which then the commercials last for like, you know, 9 minutes, which makes no sense. And also, and there's very few of them. So that conceit immediately drags you out of the story. Like, it makes zero sense, you know, but I guess I see what they're saying. They go, okay, if we're going to make a found footage movie, it's not like we can just like leave we have to have this, all this backstory built up, that we're going to get through expositional scenes, during the commercial breaks. How else are we going to do that? Oh, they were filming a behind the scenes stuff at the time, which makes no sense. You know, they never mentioned the cameras. They never acknowledged them at all. So it's absolutely stupid. That being said, there's also the problem of like the look of the movie. Like, it does not look at all like it was shot in 77, you know? And these are like, I mean, they're sort of nitpicks, I guess, but they, you know, it's like, if your conceit is that this is found footage, make it look like found footage. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't look like any late night show you've ever seen being shot. There's constant shots of the audience, like nonstop. Like, you never see the audience in the 70s. They barely cut the audience on the Jimmy Kimmel Show now, you know? So it's absurd to think they would be cutting to the audience constantly. And then, you know, of course, the main story here is that there's a little girl in this movie who's possessed by the devil. And this guy's David Dastmalchian. I don't know how you say this guy's last name.
I think it's just like Dastmalchian.
Dastmalchian? Yeah. Okay. Dastmalchian's, he plays a guy named Jack Delroy who's like a... He used to be on top of the world, but he's sort of like failing in the ratings now to Carson, which I like. This is a great idea. Like having a late night host in the 70s who's in competition with Carson be like the lead in your movie. That's a cool idea. I like that idea a lot. And I don't mind Dastmalchian as this character. Although, you know, he's not excellent, but I you know, he's a likable guy. I like him as a character actor. I don't mind seeing him.
Yeah, I generally like him.
Yeah. Everyone else in this movie gives some of the worst performances you've ever seen committed to film, especially the little girl and this fellow who plays Haig, Ian Bliss. He's like a skeptic who's on the show, who's like a debunker. He's like really awful. Anyways, this movie eventually sort of devolves into like, it's trying to be Mandy really bad, like Panos Cosmatos, like ripoff, you know, bad gore, like intentionally bad gore, horrible effects, and like weird psychedelic imagery. And it just doesn't really work. Although I will say those last 10 or 15 minutes elevate it slightly from where it was going into it. But there's a big backstory going on with Jack Delroy sort of like making a bit of a deal, if you know what I mean. I won't say any more about that. And yeah, I don't know. It's just not a, this is not a good movie, but, and it's not even like to the point where I'm like, but I look forward to what the Karens have for us next. I don't, these guys are obviously like, they wrote this script and it looked better on paper than what they were able to deliver.
Mm.
So I'm assuming they wrote the script actually. I don't even know. Yeah, they did. Okay. So, anyways, yeah, I would say avoid it. I know JR won't, but Kevin, you got to avoid this thing. Okay. Don't bother.
Yeah, I mean, I
know you had no plans to watch it, but
yeah, I mean, I saw Blake watched it, and I think he gave it like 3.5 or something. But I mean, it's more up his alley. So
sure, okay, that's fair. Yeah, honestly, it's just maybe it's just not for me. Maybe I'm just a grumpy guy when I watched it or something. But I don't know.
So I choose to believe. Sorry,
that's fair.
I choose to believe that you're grumpy and you're just in a mood when you watch.
I will
this.
Say that I was looking forward to watching it when I watched it. It sucked it right out of me. 5 minutes in, I was done. I was like, Kevin?
I'm done.
JR?
I'll just mention The Iron Claw. So you guys talked about this.
You'd watch this.
A bit. Yeah. And finally got around to it. It finally came out on Blu-ray, or at least my library finally got it on Blu-ray. I liked The Iron Claw, and I liked the performances in The Iron Claw. I think the movie was maybe a little bit like lacking in its structure. I wish that it wasn't told in such like just a straightforward this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened kind of way. And I know part of the tragedy of this family was like the losses were, or at least like the first one was sudden. But I wish that they had presented them in a way that was maybe a little bit more just cinematic. Cause it eventually feels like a pretty hardcore piling on. And again, it's real. I know it's real. I know they changed details and we're missing a brother. But
yeah, it's actually not as much piling on as it is in reality, which is insane.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But I still, again, I think Zac Efron was incredible in it, and I liked everyone.
Did you ever think you'd end up saying that sentence?
Never. No. Zac Efron was inconceivable.
Did you cry?
No, I didn't. And then there was also like his wife, Lily Collins,
mm-hmm.
and she's fine.
Lily James. And
Shit, I always get them confused.
I'm just looking at the credits right now, so.
But in she was fine, and like their relationship wasn't bad or anything, but it's like there was no reason for her to be like attracted to him. Mm-hmm. Initially, she just like sees him. She went to the wrestling event, sees him, is like, I'm gonna go talk to that guy, and we're just gonna get married, basically.
His power of celebrity.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he was a little. I guess it's hard for me to tell like what is what in terms of like the wrestling world at that point.
Yeah,
it's
locals,
like,
local.
He's clearly like a regional, regionally important wrestler.
You think that the Fish from 98.1 didn't get laid back in the day? I mean, local celebrities can use their power.
Yeah, you are. I'm sure you're right about that.
Yeah.
And again, I like the movie. I just thought there could have been some things added to deepen the characters and just make it a little bit better.
Yeah,
a little bit more cohesive.
I think I agree. I did, but I agree also that Zac Efron was very good in it.
Yeah,
for weirdly sure. Good.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry, I watched Asphalt City. This is my last one. This was originally titled Black Flies. And all of the marketing and sort of reviews leading up to it. Even I think it played at Cannes as Black Flies. It's directed by Jean-Stéphane Sauvert, who also did A Prayer Before Dawn, which I believe is a movie about boxing in a Thai prison, which I've been meaning to see for some time. Haven't gotten around to it. I might skip it now. And he also did Johnny Mad Dog, which looks like it's about child soldiers. Yes, it's about child soldiers in an unnamed African country in 2008. Anyway, this movie is about Asphalt City, that is about paramedics in New York City, present day. The grizzled veteran, Sean Penn, who... I'll tell you, just for looks, you couldn't pick someone more haggard looking. This man looks like he's been through the mill, Sean Penn. And he looks like shit, you know? he's just leathery, you know? Absolutely leathery. He plays Gene Rutkowski. They call him Rut. And then Ty Sheridan, because he's in a rut, get it? Sheridan plays the rookie paramedic, Ollie Cross. And herein lies the first of many issues, okay? I don't mind Ty Sheridan. I think that I want to like him. He tries really hard. And he seems like he's trying to make good decisions post his attempt at Spielberg blockbuster success years ago. But... his character, and this is not his fault, but his character is so sort of inept and clueless. And it's just like, don't you think, like, before you go out on your first, like, big time New York City shift as a paramedic, that you would have been, like, training for a long time? Like, I have high school students who are seniors now who are training to be EMTs, and they go out on EMT calls now in ambulances and do this kind of work. And they're teenagers. This guy's 25 years old, 27. Yeah, I would imagine he's seen some of this stuff before, and he like knows, okay, when this guy can't breathe, I need to get him oxygen. He doesn't need to have like random other paramedics screaming at him, come on, rookie, grab the oxygen, dumbass. You know, like, he just seems like he's totally like has no idea what he's doing. And it just rings so untrue to me. It's brutal, especially since one of the other paramedics who's very, very angry with him all the time is played by Michael Pitt, who gives possibly the worst performance of his career as LaFontaine, the angry sort of punk rock version of the paramedic who always wears his cap backwards. His shirt is untucked, you know, and he's always yelling at young Ollie Cross, played by Ty Sheridan. You know, you got to move quicker. We can't care about that right now. That's stupid. We got to help this guy instead. And it's just so bad. And the writing in this is terrible. It's very self-serious. It's very grim. There's a lot of just like gross imagery, you know, that's, you know, it's just there because by virtue of the fact of what kind of movie it is and this Sauvaire guy wants to shock the audience. There's, you know, I, going into this, I was like leery to watch it because I was like, I just know there's going to be like a kid dying at some point or a baby getting thrown out a window or something, you know, just like this crazy shit like that, you know, cause New York is such a cesspool, you know? And sure enough, I mean, honestly, the entire movie pretty much hinges on a baby death, and it's brutal, and it's unpleasant. And the Callie Reese is in this from Night.
Your
Night,
favorite show?
Yeah, and she's actually not terrible in it, to be honest, but she's not in it very much. But and Catherine Waterston has one scene as Sean Penn's estranged ex-wife and baby mama. And the only redeeming thing about this movie, well, actually, I'll say the cinematography is pretty good. And this movie looks pretty nice, actually. I'm not sure how they shot it, but it looks decent. But the other redeeming thing is Mike Tyson is in this movie as the, what, captain of the paramedic squad? Like, he's the guy giving out the orders. He's like the chief.
Wow.
And his performance is atrociously bad, but it's like so bad that it's funny and good. Like, it's, I had a blast watching him try to act with Sean Penn. And it's just his form of acting is just like, he's got to yell. So he's just like, hey, you can't do that. And he's just like waving his hands in front of his face. No, you can't do that anymore. You got to go out with this guy now. Don't you ever do that again. he's the worst. Oh, it's so good. I'm not usually a so bad it's good kind of guy, but I'll tell you, Tyson in this movie, so bad he's good. It's amazing. And nothing else about this is watchable, really, except for, again, the cinematography is solid. And these guys, these actors are trying their hardest. And Ty Sheridan's trying a little bit too hard. Ty Sheridan's performance in this reminds me of Logan Lerman in Fury, which will mean nothing to JR because he still hasn't seen Fury, but
no, never will.
It's a very much of a overactory sort of a young person performance. He just doesn't have it yet, you know. I think he's trying. He wants to have it, but he just doesn't have it. Maybe someday he'll fall into the right picture and, you know, he'll impress some people. But this isn't the one, guys. 2 stars for Asphalt City.
Yeah.
1 for Mike Tyson and 1 for the cinematography.
Whew. Not much positivity on this episode, guys.
Oh, no. I wanted to get out and see Challengers, but I asked Kevin to go. He was busy. I asked, we were busy, right, Kevin? Didn't I ask you to go?
Yeah, we were swimming.
You were busy. Jonathan was busy. Everybody's busy. So I was like, I'm going to go on by myself too. So I just wasn't into it. I wanted to
see. And we're still 0-3 seeing Civil War.
I mean, Civil War is going to be a video release for me, man. I don't have to wait till it comes to the Plex at this point. If I'm going to go to the movies now, I'm going to see Challengers. Especially after Frank from Film Junk gave it a 6 out of 5.
Well, so that means you're not in. No, if Frank loves it.
Yeah, I know. Frank's
Jason's in Luca's bag, man.
I love
it. Has Luca. Been for the last Sean, 2 years.
Sean gave it 5, so I mean, I think Sean has his head on his shoulders. Anyway, so it's next time is Kevin's pick. Kevin, what are we watching on the next episode of the Filmiac podcast?
Next time on the Filmiac podcast, we are watching Kundun by Martin Scorsese.
Kevin.
Wow.
Thank you. Thank you for forcing me to watch this movie finally.
You're welcome.
Really, I have been meaning to watch this for so long. It's probably since the first season of Sopranos came out.
Wow.
And I watched it on videotape. I didn't see it when it was actually out. So maybe 2000, 2001. There's an episode of Sopranos early on where Scorsese is going into a club, and Michael Imperioli and his crew are like trying to get into the club, but they can't get in. And they see, and they're like, "Oh my God, it's Scorsese!" And and Michael Imperioli goes, "Hey, Marty, Kundun, I liked it." it's amazing. So yeah, I want to see this. Nice. And this is supposed to be sort of like one of his spiritual trilogy, right? Like Silence and Last Temptation and Kundun, right? So yeah. I'm excited. Okay, so we're gonna be watching Kundun next time on the Filmiac podcast, and JR's gonna be watching that short film now. And until then, follow us wherever you listen to your podcast. We're everywhere. And write to us at filmiacpodcast@gmail.com. You can visit our website, filmiac.castos.com. Sorry. And, you know, till next time, thanks for listening. Bye.